Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Suggestions of peace between Israel and Gaza. We'll get details. And it may be Israel and Gaza shooting at each other these last 6 days, but their local little war actually involves so many countries, including now the United States, as President Obama has sent Secretary of State Clinton there to try to make peace. So let's talk about the latest developments and the interconnected web of conflicts and interests in the Israel-Gaza war with New York Times chief Washington correspondent and WNYC contributor David Sanger. He's also the author of Confront and Conceal, about the Obama administration's surprising use of military power. Hi, David. Thanks for coming on.
Good to be with you, Brian.
So Egyptian President Morsi, I guess, was the first to say a few hours ago that a ceasefire could come within hours. Now we have Israeli radio saying it. What do you know?
Well, we're trying to figure out under what terms that would be. And, of course, you'll remember that it was President Morsi who said the same thing a few days ago, and that turned out to be overly optimistic. But presumably with Secretary Clinton going to the region now, and she's just leaving from Cambodia, which is the last stop on the trip she was along with President Obama, directly into the region, it would be reasonable to assume that they are trying to negotiate something out that she can sort of announce as soon as she gets there. Her first stop is going to be in Jerusalem to meet with Prime Minister Netanyahu. Then she's going over to the West Bank, and she'll meet with the Palestinian leaders there, but not Hamas. And of course, Ban Ki-moon, who's the UN Secretary General, is also supposed to be arriving there. So you're going to have this sort of confluence of ceasefire creators all in town at one time.
What's the Morsi role? If he's meeting with Netanyahu, as I heard, would this be their first meeting since Morsi was elected president? And if they do come up with a ceasefire today, does he come out as peace broker?
Well, there's a big difference between a ceasefire and a peace, first of all. But the view within the administration has been that the Egyptians are the key to this because Morsi, of course, comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood, which has long been very closely tied to Hamas. But Morsi is sort of caught in some difficult binds of his own. The number one Hamas demand is to open that border between Gaza and Egypt. Now, this is something the Israelis are very opposed to because they're afraid it will become a place that the arms flow through. But it's also something that traditionally the Egyptian military has been very opposed to because it would be very difficult for them to control as well. So he's got to go win the way here with his political allies, but not do anything that I think he believes would destabilize Egypt along the way.
The BBC also reported today that there could possibly be even a larger peace deal in the works, including Israel lifting the blockade on Gaza and Egypt agreeing to help enforce against weapons smuggling into Gaza, which is why Israel says it has the general blockade. Might they be on the verge of something bigger like that?
They could be. And, you know, the fear of just doing a ceasefire is that they don't tend to hold. I mean, the status quo is very difficult to maintain unless you can demonstrate to Hamas, or they can demonstrate to their own people, that they've gotten something for this. So the trick here is to find a way where Hamas can find a face-saving way to agree to stop the rocket fire and turn around and say, we've brought you something. And the biggest thing to bring people would be relief on that blockade, so that their lives become a little bit easier. Hmm. And so it would make sense that you move rapidly from one to the other.
How broad is the blockade? Does it stop all kinds of food and, you know, other normal things from coming into Gaza as well as weapons?
It's not supposed to. Obviously, food and humanitarian aid and so forth is all supposed to make its way in. But it certainly makes life miserable for people and bottles the whole thing up. And there are these, you know, you see the pictures of the incredibly long lines. And then there are always disputes about who can come and go and what they can bring with them.
By the way, here's a clip of South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham on Meet the Press Sunday. He wasn't even asked a question about this. It was at the end of his interview. David Gregory was saying goodbye to him. And And Graham sat straight up in his chair and said this.
Egypt, watch what you do and how you do it. You're teetering with the Congress on having your aid cut off if you keep inciting violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Whoa. So how much do sentiments like that in the United States drive anything that Morsi might be doing today in Cairo or in Gaza?
Well, I'm sure they drive them some, but the main aid that the United States gives to Egypt is about $1.3 billion a year to the military, and then there's some non-military aid as well, but a smaller amount. And the concern that many in the administration would have is that if Congress cut that off, that aid is essentially, though never declared as such, the quid pro quo for keeping the peace accord with Israel. So it's not as if the Egyptians have no leverage either. There's a reason that that aid came into effect. It came into effect right after Anwar Sadat signed the peace agreement.
Listeners, comments or questions on the Israel-Gaza situation and the interconnected web of other countries that are related to this, 212-433-WNYC for New York Times Chief Washington Correspondent and WNYC Contributor David Sanger, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show. Why did President Obama send Hillary Clinton to the region today? Why would either side listen to her?
Well, he definitely wanted to show that he was upping his investment in this entire process. And, you know, one of the critiques of President Obama has been that the light footprint strategy that he's followed around the world, pulling us out of Iraq, trying to disengage more rapidly in Afghanistan, and trying to do the pivot to Asia, in other words, not to get wrapped up in the Middle East, one of the concerns is that it's been too disengaged and that the U.S. has looked like it has not been in a leadership role. By sending Secretary Clinton, he's once again inserting the U.S. in its very traditional old role there. And he's got to, on the one hand, show complete support for Israel, and he has done so in his public statement, saying that Israel has a right to defend itself against the rocket attacks that were going on for some time. But at the same time, it's Secretary Clinton's job here to, as I suggested before, find something that they can do that would give Hamas a face-saving way to stop the attacks, because there's no sense having a ceasefire if there isn't a sure way to not only stop the rocket attacks, but then to monitor them.
So are the United States and Egypt kind of the equivalent of each other in this situation? The United States is supporting Israel but trying to broker a deal. The Egyptians are supporting Hamas but trying to broker a deal?
There's a bit of that, but it gets more complex than that as well, because Egypt has got something of a relationship, I shouldn't say of dependency, but certainly an economic relationship with the United States. And the U.S. has committed itself in the past, at least rhetorically, to a two-state solution. So everybody's got, you know, a few feet in each other's camps here. The other thing that's really fascinating, though, is that this is the first moment to go see how the relationship between Morsi and President Obama can work out. The two men have not met. The president passed up a chance to see him at the United Nations in September because of the presidential campaign. They don't know each other at all. And, of course, there is a running suspicion in Washington of anybody who comes out of the Muslim Brotherhood tradition. So this is the first moment for the two of them to sort of feel their way. And there have been a lot of phone calls back and forth. And it'll be really fascinating to see whether or not they actually manage to forge some common interest.
John in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, Brian. Good morning. I'd like to ask Mr. Sanger, does he believe there's a possibility that someday Jerusalem would become an open city governed by both the Arabs and the Jews rather than the stalemate we have now?
David, what do you think?
Well, that all depends on what they call final status negotiations in a broader Israeli Palestinian peace deal. And, you know, we've walked right up to the edge of that, including some agreements over Jerusalem as recently as the end of the Clinton administration, when there was the meeting up at Camp David with Yasser Arafat and so forth. That all fell apart at the last moment. And while there's been discussion back and forth since then, I don't think it's ever come quite as close as it came then. And it would be interesting to see if in the second term, President Obama, who did not expend a lot of political energy on this in his first 4 years, decides he's got to go do it.
We have this coming over Reuters now. A Gaza truce will be declared at 1900 GMT. I'm not sure what that is, our time. And go into effect at 2200 GMT, a Hamas official says. So according to Reuters, a Gaza truce will soon be declared, and a Hamas official says it will go into effect 3 hours after it's declared. So, David, does that sound credible to you? And why that three-hour gap? Does that mean each side is going to try to kill as many Israelis or Palestinians, as the case may be, for those 3 hours?
Could well be, but it also takes some time to get out to find people who can enforce this stuff. You know, the message sending, particularly within the Hamas crowd, may not be as ideal as we would like to see it. And so if that's the case, they need to be able to fan out and tell all of their commanders to cool it. And, you know, there's more discipline and better, presumably better communications within the Israeli side as well.
So I think that would be a 2 o'clock ceasefire and 5 o'clock take effect Eastern time. David in Flushing, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hi. I have a question for David Sanger.
Mm-hmm.
Does he think that this entire episode was basically a miscalculation on the part of Israel? In other words, when they assassinated the head of the military arm of Hamas, that they didn't see what was coming down the road, but they thought they could just get away with it?
It's an interesting question, and, you know, we're going to have to wait for the histories of this to be sorted out and for people to talk to Israeli commanders, Israeli diplomats, Israeli politicians about what they expected. But I can't believe, just based on my previous experience on this, that they could think that a targeted killing of that magnitude that they then immediately put up on YouTube to sort of, you know, show exactly what had happened would go unresponded to. And there are some theories under which the Israelis wanted to sort of flesh out what kind of weaponry Hamas had, whether or not they had long-range rockets that may have been provided by Iran. There's some dispute on that issue, just what the capability was. Now, whether they expected it to turn into this kind of furious barrage, I don't know.
On ABC this week on Sunday, Newt Gingrich referred to an Iranian wing of Hamas and an Egyptian wing of Hamas relative to this situation. Are those real things, an Egyptian and Iranian wing of Hamas?
From what I know of the structure, and I'm no expert on the internals of Hamas, I think that may be a little bit oversimplified. But there certainly is an element of Hamas that has been heavily supported over the years by the Iranians. And if you believe that a lot of these longer range and more accurate rockets are in fact coming from the Iranians, that would tell you that there's a healthy trade there. On the Egyptians, has also been a long relationship too. The question is, how much do those two groups overlap? And usually I've found with groups like this, the delineations are not quite as neat as people would like to go do on a Venn diagram.
There was also an exchange of fire, and the caller brought up the assassination of the Hamas military leader. There was also an exchange of fire last week between Israel and Syria across their border along the Golan Heights. That hadn't happened in decades. Are there implications of the Syria of the Israel-Gaza situation for the civil war in Syria?
There certainly are. You know, part of the issue here is, could other fronts open up? I mean, the obvious one that comes to mind is Lebanon, from which the Syrians frequently operate. And then, of course, there are all the Syrian border issues. But it was interesting that that exchange between Israel and Syria didn't escalate, didn't happen. It happened, unfolded very differently than the one that we've seen here in Gaza. And my suspicion is that the Syrians have enough problems right now that they don't have a particular interest in making it escalate.
Myrna in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Myrna.
Hi, love you. I love your show.
Thank you.
Look, there's an issue here that never seems to be addressed, in my opinion, which is that since the Arab Spring, there are three groups vying for control of the region. They're really fighting one another, and that's Hezbollah, Hamas, and Fatah. and that any actions that go on now anywhere in that region have to do with that basic striving for control.
What do you think, David?
Well, that's absolutely right. And it's interesting that when Secretary Clinton lands, when she's talking to the Palestinians, she's going to be talking to Fatah and to Prime Minister Abbas. And, of course, they're not directly in the midst of this conflict. And so, you know, the United States has made clear that it views Hamas as a terror group, and therefore it can't deal with it directly. So it's left to operate through these cutouts, including, as we've said, Egypt here. But one of the fascinating elements of what's been going on the streets, and my colleague Ethan Bronner wrote about this in this morning's Times, is that these demonstrations that you have seen have certainly seemed to suggest an ascendancy of Hamas over Fatah for this for a while, or at least in this incident. And, you know, this has ebbed and flowed at various moments. There were times when Fatah looked like it was actually putting together a better life for the Palestinians in the West Bank, that it was doing a much more aggressive job of policing. But, of course, they weren't making any diplomatic progress. So it's interesting to see if Hamas picks up adherence in that constant competition within the Palestinian world.
Hey, where does Hamas get its rockets? Is it from Iran?
The U.S. intelligence suggests that, in fact, a lot of the long-range rockets do come from Iran. But then there are also a lot more of these sort of crude and homemade short-range things. So the kind of attacks you've seen aimed at Tel Aviv and that you've seen aimed at Jerusalem, and there was another today that fell a bit short of Jerusalem. The guesswork is that more of that technology comes from Iran. It does require literally taking apart the forensics of some of these rockets to go try to figure out their paternity.
Is this a long-lasting new condition between Israel and Gaza after this flare-up? Is that they now know that Gaza has missiles that have a longer range that can get to Jerusalem? Because that's new.
That is new, and that's really what makes this different from what happened 4 or 5 years ago. And they not only can have a longer reach, but they've got some better accuracy, not fabulous accuracy, but better accuracy. On the other hand, what you've had is Iron Dome, which is the U.S.-financed, Israeli-developed anti-missile system that has been, you know, really under its first prolonged drastic test here.
In fact, I've heard that the Dome is generally perceived, at least, as so effective that when air raid sirens go off, Israelis often go outside to watch the show of the anti-missile missiles going up rather than run for cover from the Gazan rockets. Is that an exaggeration?
Well, you know, I haven't been there during this this process, so I don't know. I've heard the same thing you have. It strikes me that it's a little bit risky, given the fact that the Dome is not 100% effective,
right,
for sure. But what's interesting is each one of these rockets, the anti-missile rockets, cost $40,000 or $50,000, and the system is discriminating enough that it's able to indicate which incoming missile might just fall into a harmless place, say the water or an unoccupied territory, and just go after the ones that they're most worried about headed for population centers. Now, there'll be a lot of interesting studies when this is all done about how effective Iron Dome was, but if 5 years ago we were on this show and talking about anti-missile systems, I'm not sure either one of us, Brian, would have bet that you could develop a system that accurate.
Absolutely. Two more things really quick, and we're almost out of time. One is the accuracy that you mentioned of the Gazan rockets that could be fired toward Jerusalem. I can just imagine if one of those rockets, because I've heard the accuracy is not that great. Imagine if one of those rockets hits East Jerusalem and kills a whole bunch of Palestinians. Then what happens to Hamas's popularity?
Well, that's a significant risk for them, and actually one that fell short of Jerusalem today fell close to, fortunately in an unoccupied area, but close to a Palestinian village.
And our next segment is going to be with Washington Post columnist Dana Milbank, who's going to argue that Susan Rice, even if the Republicans are unfairly tarnishing her on the whole Benghazi thing, is not the best person to be the next Secretary of State because she doesn't have a great history of being very, let's say, diplomatic. From all of your coverage of U.S. foreign policy, would you back that up?
You know, I think that's a hard argument to make. She's a very different personality than Secretary Clinton, for sure. But, you know, she's gotten pretty good ratings for how she's handled her activity inside the United Nations, particularly on putting together Iran sanctions, which has been the sort of hardest thing she's had to go deal with on a consistent basis. So, you know, definitely different personalities, but I'm not sure that I would make the argument that she had in any way this would be viewed as a disqualifying thing. I think the argument over Benghazi is going to be interesting, and the argument about, you know, whether or not President Obama wants to expend that much capital to get her through when he's got other things, fiscal cliff and so forth, to go deal with.
All right. New York Times chief Washington correspondent and WNYC contributor David Sanger, also the author of Confront and Conceal about the Obama administration's surprising use of military power. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Dana Milbank on Susan Rice next.